Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing craft and creative business. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 880 of the podcast, and it is Tuesday, the 1st of September 2026, as I record this. In today's show, I'm talking to Tracy Cooper-Posey about how to redesign your author business for the environment that actually exists, rather than the one you wish you were in. We talk about the hallmarks of an indie author business that persists over time, the solar sail theory of long-term discoverability, how to find and reduce the operational drag on your business, and much more. So that's coming up in the interview section. In writing and publishing and book marketing things, over on the Indie Author podcast, Matty Dalrymple talks to Jeff Elkins about reviving your backlist. A topic that those of us with lots of books in lots of different series and genres love to revisit now and then. And if you're new to the terminology, backlist is basically anything that is not the book you're promoting right now and anything that is not new this year. And as the years go by, your backlist just becomes bigger and bigger. And that is a good thing because, as ever, most of us make most of our money off the backlist. So while a launch might sort of set a book in one direction, the launch is definitely not everything. And many of our books just keep on earning year in, year out. Some of them don't, obviously. But the backlist certainly makes good money for most of us long-term authors and also for traditional publishing. So yes, the money is in the backlist. Now, Matty and Jeff note that readers don't care how old a book is. They only care if it's new to them. So backlist books can experience successful rebirths long after release. And I think this is especially true for fiction. So non-fiction, I mean, some of my non-fiction books are still earning. So How to Market a Book, for example, I am going to do a new edition next year. And that is, I mean, a lot of those principles don't age, but some of the, I guess, the tactics age and some of the tips age and there are new platforms and all that. So nonfiction self-help particularly can age more than fiction, memoir and that kind of thing. So yeah, really consider whether your books have aged, and if they haven't, then onward with promotion. Matty and Jeff also talk about leaning into marketing yourself as the author rather than focusing entirely on individual books. And that means as readers build a personal connection with you as the author, whether that's online or at events, they become interested in whatever you've created, regardless of genre boundaries, and might try other books. Also, try to get over the lack of self-confidence and a perfectionist attitude that might be stopping you from promoting past work. Jeff explains there's no objective good or bad, just different personal preferences. And so sometimes, and I know this, sometimes you might think, oh, well, I won't promote those books because maybe I've become a better writer since then. Or as I said about How to Market a Book, I feel like some of it is out of date, so maybe I shouldn't promote it at all. But then I realise that it's still helping people and people can still enjoy all of our books. So don't feel like you can't promote earlier books from your career. So reviving your backlist does not require heavy paid marketing. Jeff has successfully brought new life to older books by getting on social media platforms, and he mentions TikTok and Instagram, openly and honestly talking about his work. And this is definitely something that I'm intending to do. I want to do just a video per book and per short story, just saying why I wrote something. This is, as much as anything, for the double down on being human element of our books. I'm, as I've said many times, I'm not going to do lots of short form video, but I am thinking about just doing that kind of video. And as another example, I recently put Desecration, Delirium and Deviance, which is my crime thriller trilogy, into KU. Now, they've been out more than a decade and they've never been in KU. So putting something into KU, or indeed taking it out of KU and putting it wide, so going from Amazon exclusivity to putting the book everywhere or reversing that, can be a good way to find new readers and for the first time ever, I'm getting page reads on those books and new reviews. So good to have that moving again. And I'll probably do that for a period of time and then move those wide again. I've also been revamping jfpen.com. Well, Claude has. I've been working with Claude Code, revamping jfpen.com. And we've been building more links between the books, as well as building story worlds and linking them through feelings and tangential elements. And I'm starting to see click-throughs into my Shopify store. So things like, if you like Bones of the Deep, you might also like my short story Sea Henge because of the ocean links. And I'm also working on backlinks from books and travel, feeding into that idea of solar sail marketing, which Tracy talks about in the interview coming up. And I've always been about content marketing, and I'm really trying to supercharge that now, because using Claude Code or using ChatGPT work, you can actually get the AI tools to do a lot of the sort of clicking and linking and backlisting and all of that, which is quite time intensive work, but this can make it a lot quicker. So we talk more about the solar sail theory in the interview. Also in Writing Things, Pro Writing Aid has an annual sale from Thursday the 3rd of September until 13th of September 2026. So the 3rd of September until the 13th of September, 25% off all annual licenses, as well as story critique credits, which are super useful reports. You can go to thecreativepen.com/PWA26, thecreativepen.com/PWA26 for 25% off all annual licenses as well as story critique credits until September 13th. And on AI things, a provocative article from Tim O'Reilly, founder of O'Reilly Media, which is at heart a publishing company in tech education. And if you are in tech at all, you will likely have one or more of their recognizable books, as they have animals or birds on the front. Very, very clear branding for O'Reilly Media. Now, in his article, he addresses writing with AI. It is a very long essay with a lot of really interesting stuff in, so I'll just quote from bits of it, but I absolutely recommend you go check that out. He says, AI is a medium, like painting, sculpture, photography, music, or language itself. If AI is a medium, it is a field of possibility from which humans can and will summon up and communicate insights, truth, and beauty. He writes about an experience collaborating with Claude and says, in the course of our hours-long conversation, we made something together. That wasn't the machine replacing me. It was me exploring a new instrument. And I really understand that feeling. I know many of you do too, because that's what it feels like. It's this exploring a new instrument. And I think you only get that if you spend a lot of time with, for me, it's definitely Claude, but some of the other AI tools, you might be able to get that feeling as well. Back to Tim, he says, if AI is a medium, it will take time for its possibilities to unfold, discovery on discovery. In Western painting, think of the progression from the flat, stylized religious art of the Middle Ages to the luminous colors of Giotto, the explosion of technique and realism in the Renaissance, and the many stages since, on to Picasso, O'Keeffe, Haring, and Banksy. If AI is a medium, the idea that you can't write with it will someday seem as odd as the idea that you can't make a good portrait or landscape with a camera, only with paint or pen and ink. Technical innovations have often changed the nature of art. He talks about the history of photography and then goes into film. Figuring out a new medium means expanding the range of choices that are possible with it. That's about where AI writing is now. Most of what gets produced today is like a camera pointed at a stage. And he's referring to the time of when film was just a camera pointed at people acting on a normal stage. The question isn't whether slop exists, it obviously does. But there will be experimentation and there will be change. And there will be people who are masters at summoning words from an LLM, just as there are masters with a camera and the stories you can tell with it. He goes into many more examples and analogies, and it's a great piece to challenge so much of the drama in the publishing industry as Tim runs a publishing company. He ends with, I'm proud of the way I use AI in my writing. I'm still making very granular choices. If it's going out under my name, I make sure I'm happy with every word. I'm not saying we should give AI slop a pass. I hate it as much as the rest of you. But I've got nothing against those who use AI as a power tool to get more done or to deepen the writing that they are doing. I judge the output, not the means used to produce it. We're in the early days. The masters of this instrument will uncover themselves. When they do, what they produce isn't going to be slop. In the meantime, I don't think we should be shooting down people who are trying to push AI's limits in writing or art. Writers should be trying to figure out the medium, just as software developers are doing in coding. Absolutely, lots of interesting things to think about there. I judge the output, not the means used to produce it, is something where I presume we're going to end up there eventually. I hope we will anyway. So that is on O'Reilly.com, Tim O'Reilly, and I'll link to it in the show notes. An interesting piece indeed, given that it's written by a publisher, and also given the Pan Macmillan human-originated AI-facilitated book, The Everything Code, that I talked about last week. It feels like the first tendrils of the tide might be turning, but of course we shall see. So in personal news, I did a final pass on the dissertation, which has zero AI in, just to be clear, that is against university rules. So I will submit that in the next few days once I clear up a few last formatting questions. I'm literally at that point, but it feels like a weight off my life now. It's been a year. I know some of you will be like, really? It's been a year? Yes, I started September 2025 on this master's in death, religion and culture. And my mind has been taken up with many essays on death-related topics, from human remains in museums to green burial to Orthodox Jewish rituals to the art history of hell, AI and the digital afterlife industry, amongst other things. I've really enjoyed it, to be clear. I've really enjoyed it, and it's been very stimulating and very interesting to do academic writing, but I'm glad it's over, as I have a lot to do in the business. I now feel like I'm behind in my business and also behind with my books as both Joanna Penn and JF Penn. But there's also a lot I want to do with the material that I have been working on for the last year, so expect that to resonate in my work somehow. One thing that is not happening is a change in career. So when I started the degree, I was kind of looking at funeral celebrancy, something that would be adjacent to writing and speaking and all of this, but within the death industry here in the UK. But very interestingly, the rise of direct cremation has put a real dent in it. Not quite killed it off, but certainly in a primarily secular culture, and I wouldn't be a religious celebrant, then people are being pragmatic about death, going for simple cremation with no frills, which makes sense if people are concerned with the cost of living, let alone the cost of dying, which has gone up for sure. So all this to say that while this is the end of my master's degree, and I'm sure I've passed, but I have to wait until the end of October to hear officially, it is the end of the master's, but not the end of the inspiration and the impact of the topics. So I will be bringing some of these topics to you at some point. I'll certainly be discussing some of this potentially with my friend Orna Ross when we do the Alliance of Independent Authors podcast. We want to talk about planning for death as an author with intellectual property assets, with digital remains, all the things we have online. So that will certainly be coming up at some point. So yes, that's one big thing. And I've also been in finishing energy on how to write, publish and market short stories. I finished narrating the audiobook, editing the audiobook, publishing it all. You can now get it from my store and it's on pre-order in the usual places. All the links are at thecreativepen.com/short story book. You can get it in ebook, audiobook, paperback, large print from my store right now. And there are bundle deals with How to Write a Novel and also The Buried and the Drowned, my short story collection. Will be available everywhere from 1st of October 2026 on all the usual stores, but the bundle deals are only on my own store. It is a short book on shorts and hopefully super useful to inspire you to write more short stories, have fun creatively, as well as generate more streams of income. So that is at thecreativepen.com/short story book. So thanks for your emails and comments this week. at Avion Paris on YouTube said on Jessica's episode, "This was so helpful. I love Jessica's tip about putting what you don't like in brackets. That way, in the second draft, it would be easy to identify what needs to be revised. First drafts aren't my favourite, but Jessica might have changed that with her methods. Thank you." Thank you, Avion, and thanks to everyone who left a comment. You can leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel. You can email me, send me pictures of where you're listening. I haven't had those for a while. So yes, even if you're in a car, well, not if you're driving, obviously. So pictures of where you're listening or your favourite cemetery or churchyard or death culture place, you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. I love to hear from you. It makes this more of a conversation. And I realise if you're newer to the show, you might just think I'm super morbid or whatever, but I do have episodes on why being interested in death is more about living life to the full over on my Books and Travel podcast, for example. I've talked about that a lot more. But yes, Memento Mori, Remember You Will Die, is very much about making the most of living. So that is why I often ask people to also send pictures of cemeteries or death culture places in order to be more focused on how we can all live life to the full. So joanna@thecreativepen if you want to send me a picture. Now today's show is sponsored by Pro Writing Aid. Yes, a double mention today, because however you choose to publish, whether you go indie or you want a traditional deal, you need to make your book the best it can be. Pro Writing Aid remains one of my absolute must-use tools in my writing process. I use it to go through my first draft for both fiction and non-fiction before printing and hand editing, and I just recently used it for my short story book as well as indeed my short stories. And I use it before I send it to Kristen, my human editor. Pro Writing Aid knows all the rules of editing and helps you apply them, and of course you can choose not to make changes as you like. It helps with making your writing more active, finding repeated words, finding words and sentences you could improve, adding sensory detail, sentence structure, grammar and punctuation issues, as well as typos, spacing problems, and more. It also now has a set of useful reports, including story strengths and weaknesses, areas for improvement, and other kinds of developmental editor analysis, using AI tools to help improve your writing. So why use software to help you? Why don't you just learn all the grammar and writing rules and apply them yourself? Well, we all use tools to improve our process, and we are also often blind to our writing issues. It helps to have another pair of eyes, even if the eyes are software. So won't an editor do all this? Well, yes, they can do, but I'd rather pay my editor to fix the things the software can't and comment on things that human readers notice, like character development, inconsistencies, or plot holes. So I use Pro Writing Aid as my essential editing tool before sending to my human editor. Check out the free edition or get 15% off the premium edition by using my link, prowritingaid.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. And if you're listening between Thursday, 3rd of September to the 13th of September, 2026, you can actually get 25% off. So this is a double header for Pro Writing Aid today. prowritingaid.com/Joanna. This type of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show sponsored by my community at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thanks to the 11 new patrons who've joined this week, and thanks to everyone who's been supporting for months and years. If you join the community, you get access to articles, video and audio covering writing craft, author business and AI tutorials. Last week, we had live office hours where I went through my audiobook process since I've been human narrating the short story audiobook, and then I answered questions. The Patreon is a monthly subscription, the equivalent of buying me a black coffee a month or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous. You will also be able to get discounts when I do my next batch of webinars, which will be coming up before the end of the year. So if you get value from the show and you want more, come on over and join us at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Tracy Cooper Posey is the multi-award-winning author of over 200 novels and works of non-fiction, science fiction, fantasy, romance and historical fiction under three pen names. Her books for authors include The Indie Author Survival Guide and The Productive Indie Fiction Writer. So welcome back to the show, Tracy.
Hi, Jo. It's great to be back.
Yes. So you were last on the show in October 2023, talking about The Productive Indie Fiction Author, and we went into depth then. So give us a bit of an update on your author business and also your life, because it has been a bit of an up and down now.
Yes, it's been a very interesting 3 years, because I had just gone into remission with cancer when we were talking last. And now I'm out of remission again and facing treatment in the next few weeks. My husband got cancer and went through treatment, and he's cured. And so, yeah, life has been pretty interesting, but it's managed to, all that has made me do a lot of deep thinking about the indie author business and my own business and writing in general. So I'm still here. I'm still publishing 200 plus books now. Had to learn how to write again. But the writing has shifted a lot towards science fiction and fantasy, including cozy science fiction now, which is sort of like the new genre that's just creeping in. Mm. All three pen names have been Aurealis Award finalists, which is kind of nice. And I'm still continuing the nonfiction work, which is something that you said the last time that we spoke. You said, now that you've written one, it's likely you'll write more nonfiction work. And I did.
You did. Yeah. They're excellent books. Just on that, you mentioned cozy sci-fi. For anyone who might not know, where is that genre? Like, what's in that genre?
It's not really officially a genre anymore. It started off with cozy fantasy, was where the cozy started. Actually, technically, it started with cozy mystery, and everyone sort of understands cozy mystery. The body and the murder are off stage. There's a lot of tea drinking. There's lots of friends, and it's all very polite and mannered. You're focusing more on the emotions and the feel, and they've sort of picked up that cozy aspect of mystery and put it on fantasy. So you get books like, I think the primary one is Legends and Lattes. Mm. And it's about an orc that's running a coffee shop because they got sick of fighting, and the adventures that they have trying to run their coffee shop. So if you pick up that same cozy sensation and put it on science fiction, that's cozy science fiction. But it's so new that it's not like it has a genre, a category on Amazon or anything like that. Cozy fantasy does now. Amazon just created a cozy fantasy category just a while ago. But cozy science fiction is so new that people are still arguing over what exactly, which books are cozy science fiction, which are not.
I love that you keep, I mean, you're incredibly prolific, you always have been, but you mentioned there that you had to learn how to write again after cancer. What do you think happened, and how did you relearn? Because there are people listening who go through these similar things.
I think a lot of what happened was, well, life just became incredibly complex and challenging, and just getting through a day of pain sort of took a lot of the energy, what they call the spoons. I didn't have the spoons to write anymore. So I had to learn. And also you get chemo brain, which is the really interesting one. When I was going through chemo, I would look at a spreadsheet and just couldn't figure out how it worked. It just didn't make sense to me. So I had to hand over the finances and everything to Mark, which was rather interesting. But eventually it was really the way I got myself back into writing again, because it was such an alien idea that writing wasn't even on my radar from day to day. I just didn't have the energy or the concentration to do it. So I started off really, really small. The first thing I did was read a lot of favorite books from other authors, just to remember why I loved reading. And then I started reading my own books that I had written, just to remind myself of what I used to love about my own work. And then I just cracked the manuscript one day and read as far as I had written and thought, okay, what's the next sentence? And that's the only thing that I would let myself do, was just write the next sentence. That's it. So I wrote the next sentence and sat there and think, do I want to write the next sentence? And on that particular day, no, I didn't. But I just kept opening the manuscript and looking and thinking about the next sentence. And eventually I wrote a few more. And I think it was that coming back to the manuscript over and over with no pressure, just look at it. Can you get the next sentence written? And very slowly I started building up. And now I'm pretty much back to the speed that I was at before the diagnosis.
So I guess it's almost like we could think about it as in the same way that your body is physically recovering, your mind is also recovering. It almost feels like people want to disconnect the two. You know, if you get a physical injury, that shouldn't affect your brain. But as you mentioned, I mean, having chemo, that in itself is difficult and has impacts on your brain. But if people think about it more as an injury you have to come back from rather than just day one, you're back in, I guess.
Yes, it's really a rehabilitation style process. And you really, I think the key is you've got to take all pressure off yourself, because I know that for me in particular, because I was such a workhorse, I could feel this stress because I just wasn't getting things done. So once I gave myself permission to just take as long as it takes and just keep coming back to it, that helped enormously. But it still took time for that rehabilitation process to actually work. And there's a lot of forgiving yourself. And it has to be a gentle process, I think, because situations like cancer and chemo and whatever the situation is that's pulled you away from your manuscript, they're big life events. And there is a lot of stress involved with them, both physically and mentally. So you have to give yourself time.
Yeah, so important. Okay, well, also in these last 3 years, you, as you said, you've got back to writing. And one of the books you have also written is the Anti-Enshittification Field Manual for Indie Authors. And you also use Cory Doctorow's enshittification concept around the mature indie author industry. So just talk about what that term means. And we think it is now established in the industry in terms of what is going on there? How do we recognize it and adjust?
It's a very interesting term. It's the first time I heard it, I raised my brows a bit. I was thinking, well, that's a bit cheeky. But the more you think about it, the more appropriate the name is. Basically, Cory Doctorow's idea is that any platform, so for the sake of this discussion, let's say Amazon, it starts out serving its users extremely well because it needs them. And when everyone first got into indie publishing, Amazon was open doors and you could just publish a book and it would sell, because they would push the book and they would do everything they could to make sure that readers saw your book and things like that. And then slowly and increasingly, the platform extracts value from those users for somebody else's benefit, usually shareholders, and ultimately for itself. And you can sort of track this process where it starts off really great for the users and then slowly shifts so that it becomes a less than stellar experience for the users. And for indie authors, we're particularly exposed because our business sits on top of these platforms. So recognizing that a lot of the platforms that we use now have enshittified, or are in the process of doing that, that really helps, because I think for years we were treating everything as a separate problem. We were worrying about organic reach. We were worrying about advertising becoming more expensive. There's subscription creep. There's deteriorating customer service, algorithm changes. Visibility was increasingly pay to play, and it's so much more than that now. And the platforms keep removing features or changing the terms. And individually, it just looks like a mess. But as soon as you put them together and say, oh, I understand now, the platform is enshittifying, you can see the structural pattern. It actually applies to so many places and platforms and services. And once you see it, for me in particular, that was an enormously positive realization for me, because until I saw the pattern, I thought I was failing and nothing I was doing seemed to work anymore. But once I understood the environment itself had changed, I could stop trying to fix myself and start redesigning the business for the environment that actually exists.
Yeah, and that is the point, redesigning your business for the environment that exists. Because what you mentioned there, I feel like some people still think that organic reach exists. And I guess some people will say, oh, well, at the moment, you can still put a video on, say, TikTok, and it might find an audience there. You know, are people still building an audience in these in newer platforms? But I think that's the point, isn't it? Whenever a new platform arrives, I guess Substack would be another one, although we already see that heading in the same direction with various things. Like, as soon as you go in there thinking, yes, I'm going to get organic reach, even if there is any, it follows this way, doesn't it?
It does. And this is what's so great about it, is once you recognize this pattern, you see it everywhere, and you can actually track a new platform through that process, and you can anticipate that, okay, maybe we're going to get organic discovery right now, but that's going to diminish. And so you're not disappointed, and you're all set up from when that happens. And that means that you can reduce your dependency on these platforms and not expect them to behave like they did in 2011.
Interesting, though, with Amazon, for example, we've definitely seen that as authors. But on the other side, as a customer, I also, like, as a reader particularly, I used to find a lot of books on Amazon directly, but I'm almost entirely now finding books elsewhere, often through AI, actually, often through
Thought. Exactly. Yeah.
And then going on Amazon to maybe get the book. But it feels like for readers, it's changed too, right?
Exactly. And I mean, indie authors are particularly vulnerable because their entire business is built on these platforms. But this applies to everyone. It's not just indie authors. As you say, it's readers. They're noticing too that the decay of these platforms is starting to impact them as users too. So yes, and I'm exactly like you too. I tend to buy my books from Kobo, but I will buy my books from anywhere, and I learn about those books from a dozen different places. I don't rely on just one platform anymore. So yeah, it's really great once you understand this, because then you can build an independent mindset that lets you sort of flex around issues.
Yeah, so given that, obviously, we like to dwell on the positives here. So given that this is just a reality of the market and various platforms. So, so given all that, what are the hallmarks of an indie author business that is more likely to persist over time, given the reality of this?
Okay, well, I think that the biggest part of it is, as I mentioned before, it's the mindset. Recognizing these patterns is really a big one, recognizing where a platform is in the process, but also developing a very independent mindset. I mean, we've been saying we're indie authors since 2011, but we were still really relying on those platforms to provide most of our business. And I think these days, the new indie author is much more independently minded. Even though you're using the platforms, and I mean, we're all using them, you develop a flexibility. You understand the industry, and you're making plans ahead of it. So you've got the flexibility there and the business thinking, which really helps you deal with any problems that come up. I mean, every time there's an algorithm change, you're not going to wake up in the morning and just go through mourning because half your income has disappeared. You're ready with alternatives, and you've got different things that you can try. So that mindset, that thinking about and recognizing patterns and how the industry is going is critical. And once you've got that in place, then there's a huge number of strategies that you might want to incorporate. And this is the thing, every indie author's business is different. We're all in different situations. And I mean, I have health challenges. Someone else may have a day job. I write a lot of books. Someone may be only able to produce a couple of books a year. We're writing in different genres. If you're writing literature, that's different from the sort of science fiction that I write. So the business and how it responds to the conditions out there is going to be different as well. So what you do as an author and for your business will be different. But there's a lot of strategies that you can try and see which are most effective for you. One of the biggest, for instance, is something that you say a lot too, diversify your income. Have a durable backlist. Work to get your backlist built up. Direct sales is another strategy that I think is, I would say it's almost mandatory for every indie author these days, is to get into direct sales. And I know a lot of indie authors are going, oh, but I've only got two books. Doesn't matter. I mean, direct sales, if you can sell from your site using just a PayPal link, that's direct sales, and that works. That gives you a lot more independence and agency. Owning your reader relationships, making sure that you keep the readers close, I think that's another critical one. Ensure that you're resilient for the platform so you can adjust when there's changes, and on and on. There's a lot of things that you can do to adapt.
Yeah, I think it's interesting just thinking about when you said, for example, direct sales is good for every indie author. I would say every indie author who wants to have a long-term business. And I think that's a really key thing, because I feel like it's still important to have a difference between people who are writing primarily as a hobby or are not looking for the financial income that, you know, you and I do think about. So that, I think that's one thing. But I totally agree with you that just having a PayPal button or even selling some physical copies at a local fair or something, you know, that all counts. And I think what it proves, it almost proves something and gives you that more independent mindset. It's like, yeah, I can actually do this.
Yes.
And that is such a powerful reframe, rather than I cannot do anything except upload my book on Amazon.
Yes, and actually, funny you should mention the live markets, because we experimented over the last year with attending a few live markets and selling books. And there is a genuine power, a little thrill that you get when you sell a book and you can sign it on the spot for them and the reader is like right there and you're face to face, and that process is suddenly not this anonymous process that you find that you've sold a book overnight and you've got no idea who it is that bought it. It's that person's right there in front of you. So you can sign the book for them and you can have a little exchange. And yeah, it's really empowering to build that independence into your business.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned the durable backlist. Do you think that having books in multiple genres, including nonfiction, is part of how you can make a living? As in, I think people often think, oh, if I write, maybe if I just write 20 books in one series, I mean, maybe that works in some genres. I guess thrillers, actually, that can sometimes work. But I mean, you do so many things. Is it the 80-20 rule that 20% of your books make 80% of the income, or does it literally vary from year to year?
Well, it does swing from year to year, but yes, generally the 80-20 rule holds, but it's different from year to year, which 20% is making the 80% of the money. And as I mentioned, I'm moving into science fiction and fantasy more, because that's actually more successful for me right now than the romance is. But the other thing is too, I think it really comes down to the individual author too. Some authors do very well just doing the one genre or even just the one series. And for them, it's great. But I always worry that that's putting all your eggs in one basket. I think, though, to counter that vulnerability, if you're just doing one series or one genre, go wide. Sell as wide as you can. And that gives you a bit of a hedge against vulnerability. But I mean, it's a different situation for every author. And it's very hard for me to say, well, here's a 15-step list that'll give you all the answers, because it really, that 15-step list doesn't exist anymore, if it ever did, just because everyone's business is so different. It involves a lot of, you need to do a lot of experimenting, I think, and find what works for you. And that sounds like I'm waving off the answer, but I'm really not. You really do have to figure it out for yourself. But if you do adopt that sort of experimental mindset and say, okay, I'm going to do this for 6 months and track my statistics and see if there's any results there worth pursuing.
See what happens. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. You've also moved more into the nonfiction. And I mean, let's get into your solar sail theory, because I've followed you on and off since we met like a decade ago.
Yes, it was 10 years ago.
I know, it's crazy. It's really crazy. And for those listening, we met in Oregon at the Oregon Writers with Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush, and met there. And I've been reading your blog like pretty avidly around this solar sail theory, which I love. And now you're talking about writing science fiction, I can appreciate it more. But what is your solar sail theory and some of the ways to build it?
Okay, so solar sail theory is actually, it's a theory in science. Well, I was going to say science fiction, but it's actually there's solid science behind it. Solar sails are a way of, they think, because it's never been proven yet, of propelling a spacecraft. You have this huge sail, like kilometers wide. And what it does is it captures photons. Photons are what the sun, are light. They're basically light. So when the light hits the solar sail, it gives it a minuscule amount of push, but there's no friction in space, so that push just keeps the ship going and going. So when you've got kilometers of sail, all the photons hitting that can bring a ship up to enormous speeds, like fraction of light speed, which is, it sound, that sounds small if you're not used to science, but a fraction of light speed is enormously fast. And these solar sails can bring a ship up to those sort of speeds so that you can cross to the next star without needing faster than light travel or warp speed or something like that. Put that theory into place over the top of the indie publishing industry and you suddenly get a very interesting, it's a way of thinking about the industry and it helps you make decisions. So it's not a prescription. Again, it's not a 15-step, you know, here's how to conquer the universe. It's a decision matrix. It helps you figure out what's going to work for you. So the question is, whatever strategy or tactic or whatever it is that you're thinking about doing, you can ask the question, does this extend my sail? So does it leave something behind that can continue to make me discoverable? So, for instance, a 30-second radio advertisement probably is not going to leave anything behind that will let readers discover you because once it's aired, it's gone. On the other hand, podcast interview like this, the podcast interview that I did with you 3 years ago, I'm still getting people finding me and finding the Productive Indie Fiction Writer 3 years later because of that. So that's extending the sale. And it's just a little tiny push like a photon. Blog posts also, they surface indefinitely. So readers can find them 10 years later. And you do your, because you're the host of your own podcast, all your podcast interviews and the website, they're also creating surface area. So people keep finding you years later. So, and guest articles and a book in a library, your entire back catalogue is all part of the solar sail.
And I know people listening are going, but what about social media?
Yeah, social media is kind of, it's a tricky one because it's such a short half-life. I think on Facebook, if anyone sees your post at all, after 2 hours, it's basically gone. They never see it unless they actually go to your account and they need to have heard of you in order to go to your account and see the post. So that makes social media not really a good solar sail builder. It has other uses, and as long as you understand that it does have this very short half-life, then you can use it for the things that it's good at.
Yeah, the same with paid ads, for example. Paid ads are the same as social media, you know, perhaps a quicker push, but as you say, the half-life is quicker.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, paid ads are come and gone. There's nothing out there that will let the reader find you in a couple of years' time. So they're very short-term. And a lot of people can build their business on these short-term. They spend thousands of dollars on paid ads each month, and that works for them. But if they stop doing it, then their business halts. It comes to a grinding halt. Whereas if you're building your solar sail, it's a long-term way of setting up your business, so it just keeps ticking on.
Yeah. Do you think, though, I mean, your series of posts on the solar sail, which are also in The Indie Author Survival Guide, I think, is the book that they're in now. But they are non-fiction useful things. So what about for the fiction side? What do you suggest people do around basically content marketing?
Well, it all applies to both fiction and non-fiction. And I usually write, because Productive Indie Fiction Writer is addressing fiction authors, this does all apply to fiction as well. And I mean, as I was saying, your book catalog, because you're on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Kobo and Apple and maybe Google as well, all of those pages are part of your sale. Your own site, all the book pages on your own site are part of the sale. And there's different ways to do it, but the common one is you have this extended sale out there that helps readers find you. You coax them to come to your site, and there you try to capture them as readers. So that usually means your email list. Some people use Substack now. There are other alternatives I'm sure I haven't thought of, but email seems to be the principal one. And then you can build that relationship with the readers over the long term. And the solar sale just brings all those readers to you so that you can develop that relationship and keep the readers close. And for fiction authors, I think this is critical. This helps you build independence from the retail platforms.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting. I would put podcasting and YouTube in particular. So I had someone email, well, they didn't email, they were in my Patreon, and they said, I'm no longer subscribed to your email list because I hear from you in Patreon and on the podcast. And I was thinking about my own behavior, and for the podcast that I am a hardcore fan of, I'm not on their email lists. And I was thinking, because my relationship with those people are more auditory, I guess. And the same with YouTubers, you know, people end up subscribing to your YouTube channel. But then the problem still is, if I stop podcasting today, then I can't contact those people again. Except that I know lots of podcasters who stop podcasting, and then maybe like 2 years later, they just pop on with an update episode, and people are like, oh, I never unsubscribed to you on my feed. So that can appear years later. So yeah. I definitely still agree that the email list is primary. But if you're somebody listening and you're a more audio or video person, I think we can probably think about the relationship with people on these different dimensions.
Yes, and some people are definitely, they prefer the audio. I'm utterly text-based myself. I prefer to read. But yes, podcasting, and apart from anything else, podcasting is a way of keeping contact with the readers, and they can email you in return. So it is a two-way process, so you can develop that relationship. And that works for you, and that is a good alternative. The other thing is too, of course, every episode that you've recorded and put on a web page is also building your sale. So more and more people are finding you. So yeah, podcasting is interesting. So if you're guest posting on someone else's blog, that's somewhat time consuming way, but it does build up your sale as well.
The only problem with that, I would say, as someone who used to have guest posts, is it's still my website. And when it came to auditing my website, like, I don't know, about 5 years ago. And the thing is, because my website's been around since 2008, I had some people guest posting in the early days. And I was like, yeah, this should not be here anymore. And so I am able to get rid of people's things when they're on my site, in the same way that Amazon can take down your book or whatever.
Yeah. You know? And that's where the anti-insurification process comes in. That's where developing that independent mindset comes in. It's one of the questions that you need to ask is, how permanent is this? What happens if it goes away? And that's why blogging on your own site is probably a stronger and better decision than guest blogging on other people's sites, because they have control of that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So there's so much in these books. These are all excellent books. I feel like you know so much after decades in the trenches, and I love that you're putting out everything in these books. And I did want to ask you one specific thing, because obviously we're increasing the size of our sale, but if we have massive amounts of drag, so we have sky anchors or whatever we want to call it in our metaphor, we have to sort that out too. So in the Indie Author Survival Guide, you have a section on protect the margins. So I wondered if you would talk about the specific ways to think about what is operational drag and how can we reduce it?
Well, we just actually hit the perfect example. Guest blogging has more drag than what blogging on your own site does because you don't have control over it. So it can disappear. It requires maintenance. It takes your time. So drag is basically anything that is going to slow you down once you've built up speed using coming back to the solar sail theory. The sail will keep you moving, but because we're not working in a vacuum anymore, we're not in space, there are things that can slow you down. And particularly for mature author businesses, we accumulate all this cruft. For instance, Barnes & Noble recently changed their website so that all the URLs for a book changed. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but I've got 200 books. So every book, suddenly the links didn't work, pointing to Barnes & Noble. So the Books to Read Universal Book Links had to be changed for all 200 books.
I did know that and I haven't done it.
And this is the thing is when you've only got 5 books, it's like 10 minutes worth of work, no problems, and you just move on. When you've got 200 books, there's suddenly a big deal. And I only found out accidentally that they had changed them. And once I had confirmed that every single book no longer worked, the link didn't no longer work. It was suddenly a massive project. There's also the money drag. Everything these days is service as a subscription. Microsoft Office is you've got to pay the fee every year. And it works well in theory because you're getting updated software all the time. But you have a dozen of those or 2 dozen. Suddenly, you're spending a lot of money every year for software that once upon a time we used to pay a flat fee and that was it. So it pays to go through and figure out what expenses you can get rid of or diminish, or can you find a cheaper version? There's advertising. Some advertising just isn't worth spending the money on. If you're doing pay-per-click advertising, you need to monitor it all the time. So that's a time sink that you're blowing money on technically because your time is money. There's also you may not be managing it quite as well as you could, so you're actually burning more money because the ads are not working as effectively as they could. More drag. And you need to go through every aspect. There's time drag, repetitive tasks. For instance, Mark and I have for about, I think we're coming up on 11 years now, we track our sales every morning. We sit down and go through every platform and record the sales for that day in a spreadsheet so that we can do analysis. It's a good way to spend time because it's got extreme uses. But there's a lot of little tasks that you might do, especially if you've been working in the business as long as I have. All these little tasks will build up and you forget why you're doing them or all the conditions have changed and it's not worth doing them anymore. They may not be providing the value that they once used to. So you have to go through and make sure that you're reducing the drag on your business as much as possible so that you can keep moving.
Yeah, I had 2 more extra ones there. You mentioned the things that we do that perhaps we don't need to do anymore. If people are outsourcing, if you have virtual assistants, if you are paying for some kind of service outside your own time, sometimes you can have that going and then when you know, do you need that anymore? So I know some people still do pay for turning posts into social media or making book trailers. That's a good one. Or there's things that people are paying for. And then you might realize that you don't need that service anymore, or you don't need everything that social media manager is doing anymore. So realistically, looking at the benefits of what you're getting. And the other one,
constant review.
Yeah, kind of constant review. And then the other thing I was thinking is a mindset drag. So right now, as we're recording this in the author community, there's this sort of witch hunting going on around AI usage. And it's the latest thing that's causing massive drama. And I feel like it's almost mindset drag to get dragged into some of this drama. And it saps the energy and that can really pull on your on your boat, on your solo boat?
Well, actually, I found that, and this is all part of the indie author mindset, and it's also part of the intuitification process too. I found that I did a lot of research on AI. I did a lot of reading. I listened to a lot of different discussions about it. And then I formed my own policy. What's my policy for AI? What's my policy around AI and its use and so forth? And I find that once I had developed that policy for myself, suddenly there's not as much mental drag with all the AI discussions and the witch hunts and all the drama that's going on around it, because I know where I'm sitting and I'm quite comfortable with my position. So I think for a lot of people, it can become very emotional and draining if you still haven't figured out where you sit on the spectrum of AI use. But that's actually how I tackled it, because I was getting very tired of all the dramas. It is draining and it worries you. And so I deliberately went out and did a lot of research and reading and figured out where I stood. And that made a huge difference for me.
Yeah. And again, that's something to look at on your schedule. So maybe in a year's time, you relook at things again and change your decision. I think the same thing with the traditional versus self-publishing versus wide versus KU, and like you could just go on having all, like there are pros and cons in every single direction, right? At the end of the day, it's almost the decision fatigue is stopping you. Or you could say again, our solar boat has to go in a particular direction. You can't go in every direction at the same time, but you just have to make a decision, right?
Yes. And yeah, and I think being as informed as possible about the industry is one of the big ones. And I've spent a lot of time doing a lot of reading, not just about indie publishing over the last few years, but everything to do with publishing and also everything to do with business, because we are in business. And that's a bit of a cliche that a lot of indie authors, their eyes just glaze over when they hear that you're in business. There are aspects of running a business that we just don't get taught as indie authors or as creatives that I think we should be teaching each other or getting each other to learn, because it's basic business survival. Things like pricing, that is an enormously complex business topic, pricing. And most of us are, well, what's everyone else doing? Okay, I'll do that. And that's how they make their decisions. And there's a lot more to it than that. And it's very complex. We don't have to get a PhD in business management, but I think a little bit more awareness about basic business principles would serve all of us much better.
Yeah, there's always so much to learn, but I actually think you've done a really good job with your books. I mean, the Indie Author Survival Guide is a great place to start. They're super, super useful. But I do want to, as we come to an end, you've been doing this a long time, as have I, and we both got some battle scars along the way. But you do end your books with hopeful realism, which I like. Now, I'm definitely more of an optimist than you, but I feel like hopeful realism is a good place. So how can people cultivate that feeling around the business?
Yeah. I don't know. Are you more of an optimist than me? Anyway, well, let's see, because for me, I'm all the book writing and all the research and all the reading that I've been doing over the last few years have given me back a lot of optimism that I didn't have, because as I was saying, it was feeling as though I couldn't do anything right. So learning that it wasn't just me that's the problem anymore made it gave me back my confidence. And that's where the hopeful realism and the optimism came in. But hopeful realism, okay, it comes from understanding, from agency, and from choice. If you understand the industry as it actually exists, not as the way you wish it did, and you understand the forces acting on your business and where you sit within them, that helps enormously, just having that knowledge there, because you can see what's going on. You understand what's going on. It's not all a mystery. And you're not scratching your head wondering what to do next. And because of that understanding, you get agency. You're not helpless. When circumstances change, you can respond. You can make decisions instead of simply having things happen to you. And all of that gives you choice. You can go out and research and find out what your options are, and you can choose the best option for you. And if that doesn't work, you can go and try something else. So you've got a lot of choices and you've got things that you can do. You're not helpless. So hopeful realism, I think, is pretty optimistic.
Brilliant. So where can people find you and your books online?
Best place to, if you're interested in my nonfiction, best place to find me is at The Productive Indie Fiction Writer. If you want to find out more about my fiction, best place to find that is to go to storiesrulepress.com. And me and my three pen names are there. And also Mark, my husband, who is a writer as well. And shortly, I think another member of the family is going to be joining us as well. So it's a very family affair on Stories Rule Press.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Tracy. That was great.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled I was able to come back and talk again. Thanks, Joanna.
So I hope you found the interview with Tracy interesting, and it's always good to talk with authors who have just kept on trucking for the long term, even through the difficult times, and Tracy certainly had some of those. And I love the solar sail theory. It's really what I have been doing here with the podcast and my content marketing focus over the years, so it certainly resonates with me. Let me know what resonated with you from the interview and also from my introduction. Please leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel. You can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. And please send me pictures of where you're listening or your favourite cemetery, churchyard or death culture place. And if you fancy how to write, publish and market short stories, you can get it now from my store in all the usual editions and available 1st of October everywhere else. All the links are at thecreativepen.com/short-story-book. Next week, I'm talking about what machines can't replace, why AI makes us more human, with Anna McPhee. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can find the backlist episodes and show notes at thecreativepen.com/podcast. And you can get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can find me on Facebook and X at The Creative Pen or on Instagram and Facebook at JFPenAuthor. Happy writing, and I'll see you next time.